you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week are Wade Major, Leah Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. They'll review the latest film in the Purge series, The Forever Purge. Another sequel this week with DreamWorks animated The Boss Baby: Family Business. An Australian romantic comedy, Long Story Short, is getting strong attention for writer-director Josh Lawson. And comedian and activist Dick Gregory's remembered in a new Showtime documentary. The 1955 British crime comedy The Lady Killer's been restored and is getting a theatrical re-release as we listen to music from its soundtrack. It's Film Week coming up right after NPR News here on KPCC. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us with our critics, Wade Major, Leah Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. We begin with The Forever Purge, the series of purge thrillers. This time the question, should the purge ever end? If it went on endlessly, could you even have a continuing series? I don't know. The film is directed by Everardo Goot. The film written by James DeMonaco and stars Ana de la Reguera. Wade, what'd you think of The Forever Purge?
It took forever, and I wanted to purge. I really don't like these movies at all. I just find the whole premise to be really kind of annoying. It's not even that it's offensive. It gets boring at a certain point. It's just a lot of reckless violence for no reason. The premise doesn't really make sense. The idea that, you know, we have this one day where everybody just gets all of their aggression out, and then we all go back to being civilized the next day. The Forever Purge may be the first one that actually calls out how ridiculous that premise is, which is that once the purge is done, well, there are a lot of crazies who just want to keep it going, which is exactly what would happen. Once you sort of ignite nihilism, it just metastasizes. And so that's interesting. But then they kind of try to dress it up with all of this sociopolitical commentary, make it seem like they have a message and something's relevant, when really all that's going on is that people are just butchering each other. And, you know, there's some good performance in here. Josh Lucas is awfully hard to give a bad performance. But when he's given lines, things like, "I hate the damn purge. It's awful hard to be sociable on that night." That's the kind of dialogue that you're dealing with here. And the idea that somehow this whole thing will bring together a wealthy conservative Texas white rancher and a pair of immigrant Mexicans and somehow make them appreciate their brotherhood while you've spent, you know, 2 hours or nearly 2 hours just watching relentless mayhem. It's trying to have it both ways, and it just doesn't work.
We're talking about The Forever Purge. It's rated R. It's in wide release. The animated comedy The Boss Baby: Family Business continues the Boss Baby franchise. Tom McGrath, the director, and the writers are Marla Frazee and Michael McCullers. Charles, what'd you think of The Boss Baby: Family Business?
Well, I don't know that this was a film anyone was crying out for a sequel to.
No pun intended.
It reminded me of was years ago, I went to the Old Duke's on Santa Monica Boulevard with a friend of mine. And for breakfast, we got seated at the counter next to a speed freak who hadn't come down. And everything is at this manic pace. Characters are running around. They're waving their arms. They're shouting. They're jetting back and forth on different kinds of toys and vehicles. And it's really not about much of anything. The two brothers from the first film have grown up, but they are somehow regressed back to being little kids again. And their new, the daughter of the square one is at this weird special school that's actually part of a sinister plot run by a professor that Jeff Goldblum voices. I mean, he's an actor who I usually adore, and I was kind of embarrassed for him in this. It's not really about much of anything. It just zips around, and then we're supposed to have this warm bonding moment. But they don't trust themselves or their audience to present that kind of moment. And before it's really landed, they're off tearing off on something else. And something I've complained a lot about in recent American animated films and wondered Wade's thoughts as the father of a daughter. I think we are shortchanging little girls in this country by suggesting you can only be a spunky butt-kicking heroine or you're really not anything. And the film isn't much of anything.
The Boss Baby Family Business, Lael.
Well, I didn't hate it as much as Charles seemed to dislike it. I for the first half, I actually thought there were tender moments and it was kind of charming and engaging. And I thought the notion of, let's say, a dad being sad that his eldest child no longer needs him. There was some tenderness with that. And then all of a sudden, his younger child turns into the Boss Baby Redux, voiced by Amy Sedaris. And things start to get a little bit frenetic, and it sort of becomes kind of Spy Kids meets Baby Geniuses meets some really overdone, overblown effects and some kind of just weird stuff that didn't really need to be in this movie. But I still enjoy hearing Alec Baldwin as a baby genius and having, you know, enjoyed him as Trump. It was sort of fun to see what he could bring to this part in the redux of it. And I actually, you know, it wasn't a complete success, but it wasn't a complete flop for me either.
Wade, what'd you think of The Boss Baby Family Business?
I probably split the difference between Lael and Charles, I think. I respect the technique of it enormously. I mean, there's a ton of technology and artistry in the animation. It's very impressive to look at. But there just isn't a story there. I wish that they had taken some of the money that went into all this technology and put it toward actually writing a script, building characters, developing some real emotions. Instead, it just, you know, it really does just borrow all kinds of frenetic, manic energy from other movies. And I didn't buy the relationships. I didn't buy the central conceit that, okay, you know, we're going to turn them into babies again and we're going to kind of try to somehow recycle this concept. And then it, you know, goes off into kind of Incredibles 2 territory. And it never, you know, it's charmless. It's a lot of effort in the service of something that is ultimately very charmless.
The film is The Boss Baby Family Business, the animated comedy, rated PG. It's in wide release and also streaming on the NBC Universal streaming service Peacock. Long Story Short is an Australian romantic comedy starring Rafe Spall, Zara Newman, and Ronnie Cheng. Josh Lawson, the writer and director of Long Story Short. Lael?
Oh, Larry, well, Long Story Short is as charming as Boss Baby was charmless. It is just an absolutely delightful Australian romantic comedy, kind of in the Groundhog Day mode, but also very much its own thing. The notion is that Rafe Spall, the husband, Tim, is someone who procrastinates with everything in his life and can never never commit. And he's put off proposing to his girlfriend for many years. And when he finally has agreed to marry her but can't nail down the date, a woman at a graveyard comes up to him and says, "I'm going to give you a great gift." And what that gift turns out to be is that he will jump ahead a year every day of his marriage. And so in 10 years, he's only been married really for 10 days, but he has lost all this time. And so it's wonderfully portrayed. Rafe Spall is so nimble and gets every comic beat. The only problem I really had with this, I wish we could have seen Tim being a jerk because we only hear about it from others, but it would have been nice to actually experience that. Ronnie Cheng is terrific in the supporting cast. And I just thought this was a really lovely sort of writer-director calling card that I would love to see. I would really love to see more from Josh Lawson. I thought it was terrific.
Long Story Short, Australian romantic comedy. Wade?
Yeah, I agree. Josh Lawson, I want more from him. Rafe Spall, by the way, is pretty much the only non-Australian in this. He's Timothy Spall's son. But he's perfect casting, and everyone else is wonderful. Zara Newman, whom I've never seen before, is an absolute delight, and I'd love to see more of her. What I thought was super clever about this is, yes, it's semi-Groundhog Day, and it references that. You know, he at various points says, what's happening to me is kind of like in Groundhog Day. Not completely. It's you know, not the same day over and over. It's just that I keep jumping ahead in time. But in a way, it's also like an inversion of It's a Wonderful Life. So you're getting those two films kind of squeezed together in a way that is original yet referential, and it doesn't lose track of its own heart, its own soul, and its own message. And it's a wonderful trick, and I think Josh Lawson is super clever, and I hope we see a lot more of him.
Double strong recommendations from Leyland Wade for Long Story Short. It's rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Theater, and it's available on multiple on-demand platforms, including Vudu, Fandango Now, and Google Play. The sci-fi action film The Tomorrow War stars Chris Pratt and Yvonne Strahovski, J.K. Simmons in the cast. Chris McKay directed and Zach Dean wrote The Tomorrow War. Wade?
Oh, I so wanted to like this. It mashes up way too many movies in a really kind of a clumsy way, and it ruins a promising premise, and the premise is this. That Chris Pratt is a father and he's just living his life and trying to sort of, you know, get a better job, and he's a former special forces guy too. So suddenly these military people from the future arrive and they say, we're fighting these horrible, horrible monsters, these alien monsters 30 years in the future. They're about to wipe out humanity, and we need to start drafting people from the past to come into the future for 7 days and help us fight, or else humanity is doomed. And it's a great premise. You get into all of this stuff. You know, now there are anti-war protests, and, you know, we don't think this is right. And, I mean, it does touch on a lot of these really interesting sociopolitical ramifications. But then what happens is Chris Pratt gets drafted, and he goes forward into the future. And it starts mashing up, you know, A Quiet Place and the Alien films and the Terminator films and Jurassic Park and World War Z, zombie movies, Starship Troopers. All of these things kind of get mashed up in the way they execute this fight against these monsters, which are just disgusting. It's like they keep taking the raptors from Jurassic Park and making just more and more nasty and vile versions of them just to creep you out. And eventually it starts creating all these holes in the story that it can't plug, and it doesn't make any sense, and they wind up having to give you a big finale that's really kind of jumping off a cliff into something that also really doesn't make any sense. And it winds, you know, I have problems with the casting and some of the effects as well, but in the end, it's a great premise that is ill-served by just too many people meddling with it and saying, we have too many other movies that this needs to look like. And if they had just stuck with that premise and let the premise dictate how they executed it, it would have been a better film.
The Tomorrow War. Lael.
Yes, I think I pretty much am right there with Wade. I did want to like it, and I did at times. I really liked it. Also, a really nice but underused J.K. Simmons. He plays Chris Pratt's estranged father, who, you know, at one point he is brought in to sort of potentially help the situation, and but there's so much tension between the two of them, we don't know if it's going to work or not. Chris Pratt is just tailor-made for these parts. He's, you know, defending the world against massive, angry CGI-rendered creatures in a futuristic war. I agree with Wade that, you know, it was the aliens were, it's almost like a pastiche of things we've seen before. They were sort of weird scorpion-like dinosaurs, but all they're called white spikes. And they're, you know, the only thing really unusual or weird about them is that they're all sort of white. But it's, you know, it's not a great film. It does propel you forward, and it is kind of suspenseful, but I wish I had had Andy Klein on hand to explain to me the time travel.
Because he's an expert in all time travel.
He is an expert. Andy is the time travel expert.
He's the guy.
I could not, like, they, you know, each time travel movie has its own set of rationalities, and some of this, they have this notion that you're on parallel rafts, and you can jump from one raft to your present into your the future, but and you can jump back, but only once. But then, you know, then they keep changing the rules, sort of. So it That to me is always a little bit convoluted and frustrating.
Andy could do 5 minutes on that. In fact, next time he's on, we should just ask him to review this film so he can explain the time element of it.
Yeah. We really should. So that to me was annoying. But, you know, on the whole, I think it was not as bad as it could have been. And I think some people will really enjoy it.
We're talking about The Tomorrow War, starring Chris Pratt, Yvonne Strahovski, and J.K. Simmons. Chris McKay is the director. Zach Dean wrote the screenplay. The Tomorrow War is rated PG-13, and it's streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Coming up later this hour, we're going to reprise significant portions of our Film Week and Chill virtual event. It's a terrific night with the creators of Airplane, the classic 1980 parody film, the comedy which parodied an earlier airplane disaster film. We're going to be joined by the creative team as well as the stars of the film, and you'll hear excerpts of that. That's coming up later this hour on Film Week on KPCC. Joined by critics Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Wade Major of Cinegods.com, Leo Lowenstein with us as well. Coming up, we'll hear about the new documentary, The One and Only Dick Gregory, the comedian who was groundbreaking in multiple ways and went on to be a highly prominent activist. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Leo Lowenstein, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Next up, the documentary The One and Only Dick Gregory, which is full of archival footage of Dick Gregory from his early appearances on network television, his tremendous success as a stand-up comedian and social commentator, who then becomes a prominent figure in the civil rights movement. Later on, also with the nutritional product that he sells in commercials and across the country. The One and Only Dick Gregory is directed by Andre Gaines. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, I think it's odd that Gregory had kind of dropped out of the conversation because on the one hand, he was a hysterical comedian and the clips that they include in this remind you of that. And then he went on to become, as you said, you know, a very important civil rights activist. And this is a very powerful, very moving portrait of him and his work that shifts between those two tones where you have him on like Jack Parr cracking everybody up and then working with Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King and being such an effective and powerful spokesman and advocate. The two weaknesses, I would say, in the film are that it's a little bit padded with stock footage, and two, they really kind of soft pedal the whole nutrition project or product that he was selling. And I don't know how effective it actually was or what became of that. And it seems that there was some financial chicanery where he was dropped from it or it was taken away from him. And then suddenly he was broke. So those parts are, I think, are a bit problematic. But both him as a performer and him as a leader and activist are very interesting, very powerful, and often quite moving.
I loved seeing the clips of him performing. We're scheduled to talk with the director of the film, Andre Gaines. Hopefully that'll be on next week's Film Week. You'll get to hear that conversation. But Charles, I agree with you. I wanted a nutritionist to come on and talk about the Bahamian diet and, you know, what was in it? And what it did. And it sounded like it evolved, too, that it wasn't just one thing forever. Wade, what did you think of The One and Only Dick Gregory?
I actually largely agree with Charles. I agree with the criticisms, I think, but I think they're minor in the overall accomplishment. You know, Dick Gregory is a monumental figure, and a few weeks ago with the passing of Paul Mooney, when we eulogized him, I remember mentioning that you know, there are two great comedy traditions in America. There's the Jewish tradition that comes out of the Catskillian tradition, and then there's black comedy from the inner city. And they both come out of oppression and marginalization. They both came out of clubs that were very, you know, separate. and came into the mainstream as a result. And Dick Gregory was one of the seminal figures. I mean, you know, there really is only Dick Gregory, Bill Cosby, Godfrey Cambridge, and Red Fox at the very beginning. And they all did clubs in the late 50s and then kind of exploded in the 1960s around the same time. But Dick Gregory wasn't just a comic. He lived like six different lives. And, you know, if you grew up when I grew up, Dick Gregory was, you know, with the salt and pepper beard, and he was already doing the nutrition thing. And, you know, I kind of missed that early Dick Gregory phase where he was this barrier smashing comic who, you know, broke barriers on television and crossed over and just it changed the face of stand-up comedy. So it's amazing to sort of see all of these lives compressed into one film, and you get this magnificent tapestry of this very complicated but incredibly gifted man who just lived so many colors of the rainbow. It's really it's quite a trip. I find it very, very touching.
I also enjoyed the present day comedians who he had become friendly with. You know, Chris Rock is interviewed, Dave Chappelle, a number of others, and they have funny anecdotes about him later in life, and also talking about the tremendous figure that he is historically in American comedy. The one and only Dick Gregory, it's a Showtime documentary which premieres Sunday night, July 4th at 9 o'clock, and is available on demand on Showtime and with reprise airings on the Showtime cable channels as well. Andre Gaines is the director. The one and only Dick Gregory is unrated. No Sudden Move, a crime drama, stars Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, David Harbour, and John Hamm. Steven Soderbergh, the director, Ed Solomon, wrote No Sudden Move. Wade?
Welcome back, Steven Soderbergh. This is he's never really gone away, but this is the Soderbergh film that those of us who grew up on Soderbergh, which is weird for me to say because we're about the same age, but this is the Soderbergh film I've been waiting for him to come back to. This is a Soderbergh noir, much like what he did in The Underneath, and a few other films. I mean, it's really, really smart. He got a great script from Ed Solomon. It takes place in 1956 Detroit, and it starts with a scenario where some guys are being conscripted to pull off a crime, Don Cheadle and Benicio del Toro in particular, and they need to kind of shake down this guy, this businessman, played by David Harbour, and his family. There's some money involved. We don't quite know why. We don't know what's up. We don't know who wants what. And by the time this thing is over, all of these pointers have shifted about a dozen times. There's more money involved. There are more people involved. And you don't really know what's going on. It's a little bit like what the Coens did in Miller's Crossing. It just keeps changing on you and moving the goalposts and reinventing itself. And you may need to see it multiple times to fully appreciate it and put it all together. But it's a wonderful film. It's smart. It's well shot, again, by Soderbergh using his pseudonym. And it's just, I think it's a terrific film. And maybe one of the best films of the year so far.
No Sudden Move. Lael?
I think, yes, Soderbergh is back. And it's really refreshing to see him doing what he does best, which is to take a format with which he is familiar, which is the genre, the gangster film. And he's done, you know, big budget with the Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12 movies. And he's done smaller budget. And he's done, you know, The Underneath and things like that. And also, of course, Out of Sight, being a kind of a noirish romance that he did as well. He is so good when he's experimenting within a genre that he's familiar with. And he's doing that here. We don't, as Wade said, we don't have all the details of the plot, and you don't really need them. Sometimes it's a little bit frustrating, and particularly there are many, many double crossings and triple crossings, and you don't really know exactly why the guys are after this particular money or this document. But it doesn't really matter that much. It does all become clear in the end, and as Wade said, yeah, you might want to see it a couple more times. I really loved the stylistic touches, Soderbergh using unusual lenses, fisheye lenses, at times traditional noir low-key lighting, but at other times really odd things, like violating some of the editing patterns that we're so used to seeing. He does some of that. So I thought this was a pretty good yarn from one of our most experimental and gifted filmmakers, and really great cast and a pretty good, if perhaps convoluted, script, yes, by Ed Solomon.
No Sudden Move, starring Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, Steven Soderbergh directing. It's rated R, and it's on HBO Max. The Lady Killers, a 1955 crime comedy from Ealing Studios in the UK, stars Alec Guinness, Cecil Parker, Peter Sellers, Herbert Lom, tremendous cast under the direction of Alexander McKendrick, and William Rose wrote the screenplay. It's getting a re-release. Wade, tell us about The Lady Killers, which, if I recall, was remade, I don't know, a decade ago or so?
Well, more than that. It was 2004. The Coen brothers did a remake with Tom Cruise heading it up, which was a nice try.
Tom Hanks.
Oh, that's right. Tom Hanks. Sorry, I didn't mean Tom Cruise. Yes, thank you, Tom Hanks. But it which didn't quite work very well. The original 1955 is one of the great Ealing comedies of all time. It looks so good. It's the color. It has been restored in such a beautiful way. It's like you're watching it fresh all over again. It's basically a group of five really misfit criminals who try to pull off a bank robbery while renting a room in this little old lady's bed and breakfast. And of course, you know, they wind up not being able to pull everything off very intelligently because the little old lady is just, she doesn't go away. She's always in your business, and she just winds up eventually knowing too much. And then it takes all these wonderful twists and turns. It's very funny, very clever. Peter Sellers, so young, he still has baby fat on his chin, and he's so good in this. And Alec Guinness with the prosthetic teeth, it's one of his most memorable performances. I love this film. I have a book by Alexander McKendrick where he talks about all this and all of his various, you know, approaches to filmmaking. And just an absolutely superb filmmaker, knows comedic timing maybe better than any other director of the period.
We're talking about the original Lady Killers from 1955, Lael.
Yeah, they don't make them like this anymore, and I think that's one of the reasons perhaps that 2004 Coen Brothers remake didn't take off, because this was in and of itself, you know, perfect example of its time and what Ealing Studios did, which was to make these wonderful comedies, these classic, you know, just to remind people, Kind Hearts and Coronets, The Lavender Hill Mob, Passport to Pimlico. A lot of these were what they called the carry-on movies that, you know, sort of summoned up the spirit of England and in some ways kind of poked gentle fun at the English spirit. And that's what we have here with Katie Johnson as this naive and overly trusting, but also kind of inadvertently brilliant old lady, Mrs. Wilberforce. In Alexander McKendrick's direction, all of these actors have a chance to shine. Sellers, of course, yes. Guinness with the ridiculous teeth, Herbert Lom, Danny Green as a big guy called One Round. It's absolutely so much fun to just have a chance to settle back and watch these actors do what they do best. I read that William Rose dreamt this story up in his sleep and then wrote it out. And it is absolutely superb. What a great dream to have. And
wow.
A great movie.
The Lady Killers from 1955, restored edition on the big screens at multiple Lemley theaters, including the Royal in West L.A., the Town Center 5 in Encino, and the Playhouse 7 in Pasadena. The Lady Killers is unrated. The animated action comedy America, the Motion Picture, is directed by Matt Thompson. Dave Callahan is the writer. Charles?
Well, this is the first attempt to try and do a kind of post-Hamilton cartoon and to take people from the American Revolution and do outrageous and anachronistic things with them and throw in bits from other genres. But to make that work, one, you need to know a lot about them, and two, you need a talent on the scale of Lin-Manuel Miranda's. And these people don't approach that level even in their wildest delusions of adequacy. It's George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Sam Adams as these kind of hard-drinking frat bros using chainsaws to fight Benedict Arnold and King James, who was, of course, dead long before the American Revolution. But never mind, that's not the worst of the anachronisms or the stupidest. all filtered through the kind of warm, fuzzy sensibility of The Family Guy and other late night cartoon shows. They're trying very hard to be clever, to be outrageous, and just so over the top. And it's like watching a pigeon build a nest in a windstorm. You're more aware of the effort going into it than to any result.
America, the motion picture. Wade.
This is a hot bucket of vomit and one of the worst films I've ever seen in my entire life. And
wow.
I am ashamed for everyone involved in this. They should all take their names off of it. They should be embarrassed to be associated with it. And I'm especially ashamed of Netflix. Not hard enough. I'm ashamed of Netflix. I mean, Netflix is putting its name out there, trying to build a brand. I don't know what it thinks this is going to do for its brand. These are people who looked at Team America and thought, oh, I know what the secret to Matt and Trey is. They take animation and then they get really ironic and self-referential and anachronistic and loaded up with vulgarity. Well, that's not what makes Matt and Trey clever. That's not what makes Team America incredibly clever and funny. That's not what has made South Park one of the most successful series in history. And if that's all you think it is, you're completely missing the forest for the trees. But that's all this movie is. It's just vulgarity, it's irony, it's self-referential anachronisms. And I'd love to say I'm offended that they're releasing this on the 4th of July weekend, but I can't even get there because it's boring. It's just boring and dull and pointless, and it's a disaster, and I'm so ashamed for everyone involved.
We get to end our reviews with just an epic takedown of America, the motion picture from Wade Major and Charles Solomon. It is on Netflix, in case you missed that part. The film, unrated, feature directorial debut Matt Thompson, written by Dave Callahan, and features the voices of Channing Tatum, Simon Pegg, Judy Greer, and Bobby Moynihan. Coming up, we'll take excerpts from our wonderful Film Week and Chill event with the creators and stars of the 1980 comedy classic Airplane. In just 90 seconds, you'll be hearing parts of that event coming up. It's Film Week on KPECC.
This is Elaine Dickinson. I'm the stewardess. Captain Over's passed out on the floor, and we've lost the co-pilot. The navigator, too. We're in terrible trouble. Over.
Roger, Elaine. Roger, I read you. This is Steve McCroskey at Chicago Air Control.
Back to you in a minute. Hold all takeoffs. I don't want another plane in the air. When the 508 reports, bring it straight in.
Yes, sir.
Put out a general bulletin to suspend all meal service on flights out of Los Angeles. Tell all dispatchers to remain at the post. It's going to be a long night.
An iconic clip from the 1980 landmark comedy Airplane from writer-directors Jim Abrahams, David Zucker, and Jerry Zucker. I spoke with them recently for our Film Week and Chill event, paying tribute to Airplane. Also with us, the stars of the movie, Robert Hayes and Lorna Patterson-Lembeck. I started off our conversation by asking how it worked, having three directors for the comedy.
The Directors Guild at first didn't... would not give us permission to share credit. So in fact, I went to the courthouse and changed downtown and had my name legally changed to Abrahams and Zuckers. That was actually my legal name for a period of time. And we went back then and we won. Actually, the vote was tied and Gil Cates, who was the acting president, because whoever was the president wasn't there that day, voted in our favor, and we got the credit.
I love it.
So I changed my name.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. To Lorna Lembeck. Yeah.
What? So you had the success of the three of you writing Kentucky Fried Movie, John Landis directing, and did that give you entree with Airplane, or was it still a tough sell?
No, it was still a very tough sell. We tried to peddle it all over town. And the fact that we insisted on directing was, there were people who were willing to buy the script, but for three guys who'd never directed anything, who'd only been on a movie set once and had this outrageous idea about casting straight actors and comedians, it was a tough sell.
Not to mention the fact that we were not very impressive in meetings.
Yeah, well, take this meeting for example.
How did the three of you team up?
We were friends from Milwaukee. Actually, our fathers were business partners. Our sisters were college roommates. Our mothers were friends. And we just kind of, and Jerry and I were brothers. So, we just kind of got together. After I graduated from college, Jim was working in Milwaukee as a private investigator. And Jerry was a senior in college at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I managed to borrow some videotape from my my dad's friend, and we just thought we'd start a theater. We hooked up with another guy named Dick Chudnow, and we combined a live skits with the videotape on stage, and that became Kentucky Fried Theater.
And from the beginning, did you find your humor meshed well, or was that a matter of spending a lot of time together that it congealed?
One of the things that we shared was that we didn't want to do political humor, and it was during the time of Vietnam and, you know, assassinations and a pretty rough time in American history. And we instinctively, it's not like we said, hey, we're going to stay away from that. We just sort of instinctively chose to make fun of movies and commercials and stuff instead.
So you have the idea of Robert Stack, Elliot Ness from The Untouchables, ultra straight, arrow, super serious, and with the voice that goes with it. Then was it picturing him that you thought, well, let's do a whole, you know, whole series of characters with similar sorts of resumes, and that in and of itself is funny?
We were watching Zero Hour, and so we wanted it to look just like Zero Hour, and really very much we were making fun of a 1950s, 60s style of acting where they were, you know, the actors really took themselves seriously, and they had two speeds, on and off. and so at some point we just sort of said, hey, why don't we cast it like that? I mean, those four roles. The tricky thing was getting the actors not to just kind of play it straight, because everybody thinks they're playing it straight when they're not, but to get them to act as though they didn't know they were in a comedy. And that's what we kept repeating, and we kept saying, another take, do it straight, don't be funny. And that's hard for someone in a comedy to not be funny.
Yeah, and Leslie Nielsen, who eventually became the best at it, at the first table read, you guys probably remember, he put a little spin on it, I think.
Yeah.
And so we actually sent him home with a video, with a VHS of Zero Hour. And he watched it, and he came back the next day and had it 100%. He had that doctor.
Let me bring Robert Hayes, star of the film, into the conversation. Bob, thank you so much for joining us from Hawaii, particularly. Appreciate. You were doing a network television sitcom at the time, weren't you? And was this done during hiatus of the show?
I was doing a show called Angie at the time, and which was on the same lot. And when the hiatus came up between the seasons, it was a mid-season replacement. The first was a half season, and then we were picked up for the second season. And we began filming during that 4-week hiatus that we had, or 5 weeks, I think it was. And it overlapped by 2 weeks at the end of it. So I was doing both of them at the same time for the last 2 weeks of Airplane.
Yeah, that must have been exhausting to be working on both simultaneously. So
I hadn't been that tired up to that point. I hadn't been that tired yet in my life.
Well, and the film is so demanding. When you read the script for the film, what were your thoughts?
I was on an airplane. I was flying to Minneapolis with Donna Pescow, who was in Angie. She played Angie. And we were flying with Howard Cosell and a bunch of ABC people to Minneapolis for the changeover of a TV station from NBC to ABC. And there was something on every single page that made me laugh out loud, made some noise come out, not just your smile at it. I mean, something made me laugh out loud.
Let's see one of the scenes from the film that you're in. In this flashback within the film, his girlfriend, Elaine Dickinson, played by Julie Haggerty, visits him in a psychiatric hospital.
I found a wonderful apartment for us. Has a brick fireplace and a cute little bedroom with mirrors on the ceiling and...
Red leader, I'm going down!
Captain Jeline. He thinks he's a pilot, still fighting the war.
I found the tunnel, Johnson! It's this way! $25 for a cigarette is too much!
Oh. What's his problem?
It's Lieutenant Hurwitz. Severe shell shock. Thinks he's Ethel Merman.
You'll be swell! You'll be great! Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, start now. Honey, everything's coming up right.
War is hell.
Well, we'll get to Ethel Merman's casting in a moment. But Bob, working with Julie Haggerty, you know, I was so impressed. Her timing, her ability with physical comedy.
I'd been doing television, but so I had more experience in front of the camera than she had. She'd been a model and had done an off Broadway show, I think. But I was lucky in that I got to test with Julie. So, and I just loved working with her and Lorna. I mean, these folks are incredible. Just the most talented folks you can imagine. So I lucked out. I coasted on their coattails.
Well, you had great chemistry, the two of you. And I want to go back to Jerry, David, and Jim. Did you sense when they were testing that they had that chemistry?
They were definitely our favorites, and that's why we tested them together. So, I mean, Bob thinks he was fortunate, but we knew he was the guy.
The part of Ted Stryker, people kept coming in. We didn't think the lines were funny because they just weren't, it just wasn't happening. And Bob read, and we're all like, it is funny.
More to come on our Film Week and Chill series. We've got the creators and stars of the 1980 comedy Airplane. We'll be back in a moment.
Can I get you something?
It's your mofo butter laying me to the bone, jacking me up. Tighten me.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Cuddy say can't hang.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Oh, good.
He said that he's in great pain and he wants to know if you can help him.
All right, would you tell him to just relax and I'll be back as soon as I can with some medicine.
Just hang loose, blood. She's gonna catch up on the rebound out of med side.
What it is, big mama. My mama raised no dummies. I duck a rap.
Got me some slack, Jack.
One of my favorite clips from the 1980 parody Airplane. Barbara Billingsley of Leave It to Beaver in that scene. Let's get right back into the conversation with the creators that made it happen, co-writers, directors Jim Abrahams, David Zucker, and Jerry Zucker, casting director Joel Thurm, actress Lorna Patterson-Lembeck. Lorna played Randy, the singing stewardess. Lorna, what was it like filming your scenes in the movie and describe, because it was obviously very fast paced shoot.
You know, I was very young. This was one of my first jobs. Joel can attest to that. Yeah. I think I was very early 20s. I was just so happy to be, I was on a lot. I was in a movie. I was with wonderful people. I got to sit next to Howard Koch. And, you know, I was just so happy to be there. And whatever Jerry told me to do, I just wanted to please them. That's really, and it was just so fun. It was such a happy place. I never in my life of show business in life, I never had another experience that happy and fun. It was just a great place to be.
Well, Joel, let me bring you in, casting director of the film, Joel Thurm, also worked on a number of other prominent films, including Grease and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So we have Leslie Nielsen, Robert Stack, Lloyd Bridges, Peter Graves. and of course, Ethel Merman. So with so many of these people that audiences know, but seeing them totally out of the environment they would have been in before, was there much convincing that you had to do?
Well, the convincing, as was said before, was some of the characters who just didn't get it at first. You know, like Peter Graves, who just, you know, like you said, he threw the script across the room or something, but his kids, you know, said, "Dad, this is really funny." And, you know, and they convinced him to do it. And, you know, I wasn't there when they read their scripts, so I really don't know, but there was a little resistance. There was a lot of resistance for just the two leads. I mean, I work on movies that everybody doesn't get right away. The turndowns for Rocky Horror and this for the leading roles were enormous. Yeah. You know, people just didn't get it by reading the script.
Let me bring into the conversation our critics, Christy and Tim. Christy, what stands out most to you about the film?
Well, I was about 8 years old when it came out, and I look back at that now and think, man, my parents were permissive, because it's a pretty racy movie in retrospect. But having watched it so many times since then, the thing that makes it timeless for me is the wordplay. Because you got a lot of pop culture references, you got a lot of slapstick, you got some really amazingly clever little things going on in the background, like in that last clip with the two guys who were attached to the shoulder trying to tug each other. But the delivery, the deadpan delivery, and just the way it sneaks up on you, Leslie Nielsen especially, with, you know, things like, "It's a big building with patience, but that's not important right now." Like versions of that kind of line over and over again are what really make this film timeless for me.
Well, and to me, it's so influential, not that anyone has done parody in the same way. In fact, I don't think we see as much parody now. Key and Peele certainly, you know, with their television show, did it beautifully. But it doesn't seem to me like we're in an era where there's a lot of it. But this film raised the bar on the spoof, I think, Christy.
Well, it's so hard to do it well, because I think a lot of parodies are like, here's a thing you know, and here's a thing you know, and here's another thing you know, and we're just going to do them. And you're going to laugh out of recognition. That should be enough, theoretically. But it's really not. And so to find the balance that you guys all found here is so tough. And that's why you see so many films trying to recreate that magic. And really, none have.
Tim, you have a favorite part of this film?
Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in that extremely meta scene where he's playing co-pilot Roger Murtaugh. Who's actually Kareem. That's a scene that we and the jive talking scene, of course. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I got to tell you, guys, as I watch this movie, and I understand that you didn't want these actors playing these as comedic sort of roles, but am I wrong? And that I suspect you guys were all fans of the Marx Brothers. Do I detect some Marx Brothers fans, some Three yeah. Stooges fans, maybe even a little W.C. Fields fans in there? I'm a Midwest guy too, and I think that strain runs through us. Would that be correct?
We absolutely, we're big Marx Brothers fans. We used to, before, you know, they had the internet. I mean, when we were in college, they would have these film festivals where you'd have 600 stoned students in a room watching Duck Soup. And, you know, that really, and the zaniness of the Marx Brothers and the slapstick combined with the very witty wordplay had a definite effect on us. I mean, to a lesser extent, the Three Stooges, because they were only slapstick. They didn't have the wit, which really transcended that, all that stuff.
Mad Magazine was also a huge influence, I must say.
And later, Woody Allen. When we saw what Woody Allen was doing in films like Bananas, we thought, okay, we can do this. We could be on this level. We have this thing. But our breakthrough was doing it without comedians.
Tim, you were going to continue, and I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say that I detected a direct through line from Airplane to the films in the Black community anyway, Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle a few years later, Keenan Ivory Wayne's I'm Gonna Get You Sucker a few years later, yeah. Right through to Keenan's films, the whole series of scary movie parodies that were based on that. I detect a through line right through all of those films, influenced primarily by Airplane, if I'm not mistaken. I imagine you guys probably do too.
We saw in 1975, you saw a movie called Shaft, starring Robert Roundtree. Richard Roundtree. And it was what they call a blaxploitation movie. And we liked it, and we walked out of the theater and we said, it was good, but we couldn't understand what the actors were saying. And so we had this thought, well, what if we have these Black guys on the airplane and subtitle them with stupid white guy subtitles? And when Airplane came out, I wasn't sure, we weren't sure, was that going to be offensive or not? But when we went to see the movie with a Black audience, they laughed harder than the white audience. And we thought inadvertently, perhaps, we had tapped into the tone deafness of the white community to the whole Black experience.
My thanks to the writers, directors of Airplane, Jim Abrahams, David Zucker, and Jerry Zucker, that part of our Film We Can Chill virtual series. Also the stars of the film, Robert Hayes and Lorna Patterson-Lembeck joining me, Joel Thurm, the casting director of the film, and thanks to our Film Week critics, Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire. You can watch the entire conversation about Airplane at kpecc.org/in-person. And a reminder that you can download the podcast of Film Week wherever you get your podcasts and listen when it's convenient to you. From all of us, have a wonderful Independence Day weekend.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.